Welcome back. Here in the third hour of Issues Etc., we are going to begin a seven-part daily series with Suzanne Venker, author of the new book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. I'll tell you more about the book in a few minutes. Part one of this seven-part daily series deals with the first myth, and that is men can have it all, and most of them do. Therefore, women should also have it all. We'll find out what's so mythical about that and what's the truth when it comes to having it all. Then, in the second part of today's third hour of Issues Etc., Dr. Jeffrey Satinover will be our guest. We'll be responding to arguments for same-sex marriage. Come back to that issue. He's author of several books, including Homosexuality and the Politics of Truth. That'll round off today's conversation here on Issues Etc. Now, if you'd like to join us as we begin this seven-part series with Suzanne Venker, 1-800-730-2727. Suzanne, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, I got to say here, you ditched us for a live Sunday night program. We still got you on pre-recorded, but you ditched us for a live appearance on Issues Etc. nationally in order to do an interview on CNN on Mother's Day. Was it worth it?
Well, just remember, I have nothing to do with these things. If I had had my say in the matter, had I known what I was about to get into, I absolutely would not have. And I appreciate your having me back on for these next 7 days.
What was your experience? What happened on that that brief interview on CNN?
Yeah, the gist of that was they had set up what was supposed to be a six-minute interview with me about my book between me and Carol Lynn only. Carol Lynn is the host of that news program. And 2 minutes before I went on the air, she came on in the earpiece and told me that my book had set off all kinds of problems, something to that effect, at CNN. And then a minute after that, so she kind of, you know, this is all kind of new to me. She comes on and tells me that real quickly. And then a minute after that, they said, and now we're going to discuss a hot topic. Can women have it all? Here with us to discuss it is, and then they announced me, and then they announced another woman. And so for those 5 minutes, I was put into a debate situation with somebody in all of 5 minutes who had obviously been prepped for this because I was the one who wrote the book and nobody ever asked me about the book. So it was very disappointing, and I'm mad at myself because I should have known better.
So what happened was they told you this would be a one-on-one. It turned out to be
a debate format.
Asking you to debate someone else on the other side of this issue
of
working moms.
Which I'm absolutely happy to do, obviously, but and expect to do in the future at some point. But I need the time, and I need the heads up, and they didn't want to give me that, and I don't know why. I don't know why they didn't want to give me the heads up. And I don't know who the woman was, which is really interesting. It wasn't like any of the women that I had quoted in my book, you know, from all my research. It was the head of Working Mother Media, who owns Working Mother Magazine. And I've just never even heard of her before, but which is probably neither here nor there. But anyway, so that's how it went. So, no, I wish I had been on your show nationally and taken the second hour of phone calls.
Well, we'll get an opportunity to do that in the future as well, Suzanne. But I promise you, I don't think we have anybody waiting outside in the studio to bring in to debate you, right?
Okay.
Okay, we have no one here.
Thank you.
We will just do a simple one-on-one. All right. The first myth that you deal with maybe is the biggest one. I think the last time we talked, you said it probably is the biggest one. And that is that men, they can have it all. Work, family, hobbies, career, wife and children. Why can't women? Why is this a myth?
Well, it's interesting how we've come to learn the truth about that, what I call a myth. One of the things that I say in that chapter, probably the most important thing I point out, is that philosophy was bogus to begin with because it simply isn't true. Men never did have it all, and I go to explain that further. But what's interesting is that we've kind of joined men today and become that stereotypical breadwinner father of the 50s, and yet we're kind of struggling having it all too, aren't we? So I find it very interesting that we've kind of learned the hard way what we thought to be true about men of that time, which is that they did have it all. But what we've learned now is that work outside of the home, if it's full-time, is as all-consuming as it is to be home with children, in the sense that once you've done that for the day or for the week, you have very little left to give in the evening. And that's because it zaps you of all of your energy. So the idea that men had this life where they enjoyed the rewards of work outside the home and had these glamorous careers and then also enjoyed the benefits that come from being with children is simply bogus. By the time men got home, their kids were almost ready for bed. They're cranky. It's time to eat dinner, take a bath, and go to bed, and then you grab whatever hour or two you have left to yourself. So they didn't have what certainly full-time moms enjoy as far as the rewards of being with your children during those happy moments. So it's taken, that's kind of what I discussed in that book, that it's taken us all this time to kind of put ourselves in their shoes, in men's shoes, to see it for ourselves.
You're talking about my life here.
How so?
Well, because when I get home, it's not only dinner time, it's past dinner time. Now, I may be atypical in that sense, because I work through dinner time.
Okay.
But when I get home, I have precious, precious little time with my children, and I use that word precious as strongly as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
Bedtime comes too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
That is taken up with all the little things that need to get done, wife and husband cooperating and doing as much as they possibly can. And you talked about having a few hours for yourself, which is...
which is actually too much. That's not probably what you have.
It doesn't
probably
actually...
have 45 minutes of that.
Yeah, it doesn't actually happen that way. And you sit there thinking during those 45 minutes of time when no one is
talking to you,
you're thinking, you know, I wish my kids did have a later bedtime because... I just spent the 1 or 2 hours that I get to see them every day working through the last few bits of homework, and that often involves a lot of conflict, trying to get them ready for bed. That involves conflict. You'd like to just have some a little more downtime with them and just enjoy their time. You know, you say men never had it all. It's absolutely true. There's a lot of things missing there, but that's the way it is. Now, how... Okay, I got to do this. I got to put food on the table.
Yeah, that's right. Somebody's got to do it.
Right. My wife looks at that and says, well, you know, but what if she says, that's what I want too. I want the career. And I think I can squeeze motherhood into 2 hours there, even if it does involve all those other little chores as well. How do you respond?
Well, the reality is, well, twofold there. The first thing is to recognize that, no, you can't. It's not going to happen. So once you accept that, and again, that goes back to the whole premise of the book, which is accepting that raising children is a bona fide career, that it is a full-time job, and that the needs of children are endless, and the work is never-ending. When you accept that and embrace it, and you know that it has to get done, how you choose to do it between you is up to you. You know, there are people who tag team. Excuse me. There are men who stay home, although there's no question that it's, in my opinion, never going to be an overwhelming majority, and that's a whole other book. But today, there are certainly more what I call this tag teaming, kind of the sharing if they work in flexible job situations so that they are overlapping a little bit more. So it doesn't necessarily have to be all one or the other. However, it certainly is something that is an option and is still the way it is for the majority of people. So, how you choose to work that out is up to you. If you have two people, however, who are as career-driven as each other, well, guess what? You got a hard decision to make. But life is hard. That's the way it is. There's no rules as to who necessarily does it, but there are rules, or there should be rules, governing the fact that it has to get done.
I'm wondering about the definition of the term all here, because we've talked about it up to this point, Suzanne, in terms of time and a little bit of you know, what kind of labor needs to be done after you're done with your career on a daily basis. But how did feminists define all when they talked about women having it all?
Yeah. Well, there's no question that their definition of all is women pursuing careers in the same way and in the same fashion, which usually translates to full time, as men. So that means that if you're having that as your goal, then clearly you have a problem on your hands when you have children. Somebody has to take care of that other job. So if you're encouraging people to do it, or to not be at home with children and to do the work that men typically do, then invariably you've got this problem on your hands. But what we never understood is that all does not have to mean full-time careers. It also suggests that somehow full-time careers for the majority of people, and I'd venture to say even half, but of course I haven't done the studies on this, are so wonderful and fulfilling and glamorous that your life, that life's meaning is going to be found in these places as opposed to where it's meant to be found, which is, of course, at home. And we know this. This isn't something that Suzanne Venker came up with. It's not like I'm some spiritual guru. I pull from all sorts of places in my book to kind of defend that whole concept that obviously it's going to be at home in our relationships where we find happiness and meaning, not in the workforce.
You've also said... And this is kind of a different spin on the same question. You said women can have it all, just not all at the same time.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
And that's another important point to make, because I don't actually disagree with the concept of having it all. It's, again, as you say, that important piece of the sentence, which is at the same time. And if we just understand that we have our whole lives ahead of us and that there are seasons to our lives, that there are times when we're going to be able to do a little bit of this and a little bit of that, or more of this and less of that. And if you look at your life as a whole and you're looking at it kind of in a 40-year span, you know, and I pick 40 just because, you know, I don't know, when you graduate from college to when you supposedly retire, you have about a 40-year span there. And there's no reason why we have to delve into this specific career goal and never waver from it. That's really what my issue is with the feminist agenda, which is that you cannot leave the workplace lest you be less of a human being. It's absurd.
When the young woman goes into college, she's got a pretty much she got something in mind if she's going to college, more than likely.
Yeah.
She's got a career, perhaps, maybe in the future, maybe right after college in mind, okay? So she tries to find that track. What can a young woman do at that point in her life, before the die has been cast, before she's accepted a job that does require 40-plus hours a week, before she'd gotten into a marriage without children for 5 years where their lifestyle expands to eat up two incomes and kids just don't fit anymore without professional daycare, before all those decisions are made, what can a woman think about do in order to, as you say, have it all but not all at the same time?
Well, there are several things. The very first and most obvious thing, I think, is to pick a career that works well with motherhood. Now, when I say with motherhood, I don't mean a full-time career that works alongside motherhood. I mean, when you're looking at the whole span of your life, you want to think about a career that you can easily, A, move in and out of, or which, not to say that that's going to be easy, but it can be done, or B, one that has more flexible hours that you could do on a part-time basis, or that you could not do at all for a few years and then pick up on a part-time basis. And there really are careers like that. There's also, of course, the option of those things that you could do from home. Like writing is a perfect example, obviously. That's the first thing I would think of, since that's what I do. But there are all kinds of other computer-related work, jobs you can do from home. And then the second thing that I talk about in my book is to kind of think about where you want to live as far as when you have children. In other words, one of the things I talk about is how women kind of get on this career track because that's all they're thinking about. They think about nothing else. And then they graduate, and then they go where their first jobs take them. And this usually pulls them away from their hometowns, near their family and friends, which is fine, except that what they're not anticipating is that when X amount of years pass, whether it's 2 or 5 or 10 or 12, by the time you are married and pregnant, or actually having children, rather, you only then is it occurring to you that you need help with a big H. You know, parenting is not meant to be done in a vacuum. You need help. You need family and friends. And, of course, this is what's happening today, is that so many women are away from their family and friends, and they are now depending upon strangers, i.e. daycare, and the other child care resources around them, because they're not near that free help, so to speak. So I basically make several suggestions to women, and one is, you know, choosing a career that works well with motherhood. B, plan to live near your family when the time comes, even if you spend the first 10 years somewhere else. And then also think about your finances and what you're going to do during the time that you are not bogged down with children, so to speak, and be responsible with them so that when the time comes, you are more available in a financial way to be home with them. But just if I could go back to that career thing for a second, I do admit and discuss in the book that there are some career options that, quite frankly, are going to be a problem. And this is not a popular thing to say. And, of course, feminist groups would, you know, their antennas would go up and they'd be, you know, horns would coming out of their head to hear me even suggest such a thing. But the reality is, if you want to be the president of the United States, or if you want to be a pilot, or if you want to be a heart surgeon, or these types of all-consuming careers, you're going to have a problem on your hands if you want to be a mother, and that's the reality. So in a way, you can't really be anything you want to be, and that's the hard part, you know, that our bodies have another agenda for us, and you can certainly not partake of that. That's fine. But if you want to, as most people do, it's not going to work. So you kind of need to know that ahead of time and gear your career in a way that makes more sense. That's not a popular thing to say at all, but it happens to be the truth.
We're talking with Suzanne Venker about working mothers, dealing with the first of seven myths that she outlines in her book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers, about working mothers. Men can have it all. Why shouldn't we is that first myth. You can find out more about the book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers, at the website for Spence Publishing, www.spencepublishing.com. www.spencepublishing.com. I'll also give you the phone number, the toll-free number for Spence Publishing here in just a few minutes. You cite Peggy Orenstein in your book here in this chapter. She did some interviews, and one of the intriguing answers that a woman gave her, you quote, "You know, sometimes I wonder if we'd be happier living in a society where there weren't so many choices." What does that response say to you, Suzanne?
Yeah, I thought that was absolutely incredible and so telling. That tells me that women are overloaded. They're bombarded with so many choices today that is so that is supposedly a wonderful thing because, of course, in the 1950s, if you look, for example, at that movie Mona Lisa Smile that was just out recently, and it showed the other side of that coin, which is what existed during the 1950s, we have come so far in the other direction, thinking that that was all good to get away from where we were in not having choices, that we overlooked what was going to happen as a result of that. And what has happened is that women are so overloaded with choices, they don't know how to make them anymore, and they almost want to be told, "This, let's scoot this one out of the way." Kind of like what I said a few minutes ago when I said there's some careers that are just not going to be an option. I think that's a breath of fresh air, not something that holds women down. It's just a piece of truth that if you remove it, it's very helpful in steering your life toward something that will work for you. And the idea that not having a specific career as being some sort of horrible thing doesn't have to be such a daunting, you know, horrific idea. I mean, so what? So what if you can't do this? Find something else to do. What would you do if all of a sudden there were no more airplanes in the world? Let's say you want to be a pilot. And if you couldn't be a pilot tomorrow, is your life over? Is your identity gone? I mean, you have to find your way. And so I think that's what that woman was saying. But you, again, would rarely hear something like that because the whole idea that a woman wouldn't have choice is this horrible thing. But it's not a horrible thing. It can be kind of a good thing to go back a little bit.
In the few minutes that are left to us here, Suzanne, I want you to, if you can, explain something to me. I have noted, I talked recently with a roundtable of women on Women in Vocation. It was more of a theological discussion than the one we're having here. But one of the things off mic that several of the women said in one form or another was, "My life didn't turn out the way I thought it would." And it struck me that that women, when they're young, when they're girls, tend to think a lot about their future. They tend to, if you will, dream about what their life as adult will be. Whereas boys will do this, but often in an extremely boyish way. You know, I'm going to be the first man to walk on Mars, or I'm going to be, you know, something that they never will be. They don't dream about sitting behind a desk in a cubicle.
Right.
Or any of those kind of things. They just really, or even being heart surgeons, the things they actually turn out to do. Is there, has feminism in that sense sold that bill of goods to a lot of women that along with the fairy tale dreams, they should be having these dreams about spectacular, glamorous careers. And when those things don't happen and can't happen, they feel a sense of, boy, you know, my life just didn't turn out the way I thought it should.
Oh, there's no question about it, Todd. There's no question about it. I mean, the idea that you should focus so much of your energies and attention and pin your hopes and your dreams and your happiness on a job. I mean, think about it. That's really what they were sold, on a job. I mean, how silly is that? I mean, when we sit down and we think about how we can't find our happiness and our identity and our whatever in the workplace, well, why did we even think we could? How did we ever come to believe that when we know, just from common sense, again, not to get it from a spiritual guru, but just from common sense, where are you really going to find meaning? I mean, what is love and marriage and relationships and family and children all about? So the fact that we turned away from the home and put it toward this other place that is so lacking for so many people, once they get in there and they see, wow, this is not what I was told. This is not where you're supposed to find. This is not where I'm finding my happiness or my identity. And they definitely feel that they've been sold a bill of goods, although I don't know that a lot of women necessarily have put it together in that way. You know, I don't know that they necessarily understand the significance of what has happened in society and how that's been fostered by the women's movement over the last 30 or 40 years. I don't know that people really do. I think they just take it for what it is. You know, this is the world I grew up in. They can't quite figure out what happened.
So with only 30 seconds, maybe the earliest dreams, the ones that the girls have before they get sold by feminism, are the best. They dream of having a baby.
Yes.
Of being
mommy.
That's
right. That's right. And what a wonderful thing that is. And how sad that we would turn away from that and say that that's a bad thing. But that's what we did. And you're absolutely right. What do little girls talk about? I mean, my four-year-old is already, you know, pretending with a wedding dress. And I didn't have anything to do with that. I'm still trying to figure out where she got it. But whatever. I mean, that's what she does, is talk about a wedding. She's four. You know?
She's planning for her future. She's on a good track.
Yeah.
Suzanne Venker, thank you for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Suzanne's new book called Seven Myths of Working Mothers is currently being offered half price by Spence Publishing. You can order it by calling them toll-free. Here's the number, 1-888-SPENPUB, 1-888-SPENPUB. You can also browse before you buy at the website for Spence Publishing, www.spencepublishing.com. Tomorrow we'll be talking with Suzanne again. This is a 7-part daily series we'll be doing with them. Myth number 2, I could never stay home full time. Now, for some reason, the feminist has sold the women of today this idea that staying at home full time is little better than a lifetime prison sentence. We'll have Suzanne dispel that myth. And if they have to stay home somehow, that means they're useless to society. We'll have her dispel that myth tomorrow on Issues, Etc. When we come back, the last 25 minutes of the program, we'll be talking with Dr. Jeffrey Satinover about homosexuality, and he's going to respond to the arguments for same-sex marriage. He's author of the book Homosexuality and the Politics of Truth.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What is Lutheran theology really all about? Is it about the Lutheran Reformation? Is it about not being a Roman Catholic? Is it about Martin Luther? No, Lutheran theology is really all about Jesus. Learn more in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center, by Pastor Daniel Preuss. You can order Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center, by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or learn more about our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, by visiting our Issues, Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find out more about our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center.
Gay marriage, is it biblical?
Answers with Ken Ham,
host of a popular video called Raising Godly Children in an Ungodly World. Well, Ken, the issue of gay marriage is making headlines across America and indeed around the world. What does the Bible say that would address all of this?
Well, there are many passages in both the Old and New Testaments that deal specifically with the doctrine of marriage and the issue of homosexuality. For instance, when you read passages like Ephesians 5 and Matthew 19, there's no doubt that the doctrine of marriage, which is based on the Genesis account of the creation of Adam and Eve, is that it can only be one man and one woman. There's no basis whatsoever in Scripture anywhere for two men or two women to be a legitimate marriage. Also, Scripture makes it clear in Romans chapter 1 and many other places that homosexual behavior is a sin. It's an abomination to the Lord. For example, Sodom and Gomorrah were judged because of this horrible sin. And consider one of the primary importances of marriage anyway. According to Scripture, it's to produce godly offspring. Adam and Eve were told to be fruitful and multiply. But there's no way a gay marriage can fulfill this command. Sadly, because our Western culture is abandoning God's word as the absolute authority, people are also giving up the true basis of marriage.
Well, speaking of marriage, have you ever wondered where did Cain find his wife? Ken Ham provides the answer on our website, AnswersRadio.com. It's a free booklet at AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Physical activity is important for young, growing bodies. Exercise helps the muscles, the lungs, the heart, and the mind. But for every minute your child sits in front of the TV, that is time away from running, jumping, and playing. To make sure your children get enough exercise, you may have to turn off the TV and play with them. That may mean going for a walk, throwing a ball, or playing tag. That is good for your children. It's good for you, and it's good for your relationship. Jesus loves your children enough to die on the cross for them. He also wants them to get the exercise they need. When you turn off the TV and actively play with your child, the love of God works through you to help your child become strong and healthy. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Hope Lutheran Church and School in St. Louis is an underwriter of Issues Etc. Hope Lutheran is located at 5218 Neosho in St. Louis. Randy Asbury and Stephen Rosebrock are the pastors. Their phone number, 314-352-0014, 352-0014. Hope Lutheran Church and School in St. Louis, www.hopelutheranstl.org, www.hopelutheranstl.org. Here in the last 25 minutes of the program, we're going to return to the issue of same-sex marriage. Let's take on some of the arguments that are made in favor of same-sex marriage in the public square. Yesterday, in the course of a Bible class that I was teaching at the congregation that my family attends, I talked about some of the arguments made within the church in favor of same-sex marriage and homosexuality, none of which hold any water. What about out there in the public square? In fact, after the Bible class, some people approached me and were asking me about some of the very arguments we're going to discuss here in the course of this last 25 minutes of the program. What about the fact that homosexuality has been demonstrated by science to be genetically determined? Well, maybe we need to question whether or not that's true. It is widely believed. Once gay, always gay, widely believed. Is it true? That's the question. Is it true? We'll respond to these arguments for same-sex marriage. Dr. Jeffrey Satinover is our guest. He holds a degree from MIT, Harvard, and the University of Texas. What a trifecta. My goodness. When UT is the low man on the totem pole there. He's also practiced psychotherapy and psychiatry since 1974. He is author of several books, including Homosexuality and the Politics of Truth. Dr. Satinover, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be with you again.
We're going to go through four of these things, Dr. Satinover, but let's get this out of the way in the beginning. Why are myths like that homosexuality is genetically determined, that you're if once gay, you're always gay? In other words, it's immutably state of the individual. That all of the ills suffered by homosexuals come from societal disapproval. Why are these myths so widely believed?
Well, the simple answer is they're widely believed because a large number of individuals set out to convince the public that they were true about 20 or 30 years ago, having discovered through a series of research studies that showed that if people could be convinced that homosexuality had a biological origin, that automatically the belief that it has a biological origin would translate into a more positive attitude toward it. In other words, there was a purposeful attempt to influence public opinion by indirectly influencing opinion about supposed scientific studies. There are actually no scientific studies, however, that support it's having a biological basis.
So this is really the first one we're going to deal with here, is kind of the myth upon which the other myths stand or fall.
That's correct.
The biological basis for homosexuality.
That's right.
All right, let's deal with the first one then. Someone says, and we hear this quite often, with an appeal to diffuse authority, scientists have determined, the scientists, whoever they may be, that there is such a thing as a gay gene, and at the very least, homosexuality as a behavior is genetically determined. How do you respond?
Well, it is true that there have been many press reports of something called a gay gene, and there were a number of scientists who, in good faith, thought they were hot on the trail of such a thing. And then there were a number of scientists, including the ones who thought they were on hot on the trail of it, who stood up and used language like that. They used phrases like the gay gene when speaking to the public, and at this point they were no longer operating in good faith, because in fact, when you read their scientific studies, not the reports of their studies by third parties, or even when you read or listen to them when they speak to the general public, but when you read their actual scientific studies, or when you read what they say when they are addressing their fellow scientists, they make it crystal clear that their studies actually turned out to prove precisely the opposite of what they had hoped. In other words, all of these studies, and let me be very clear about this, and anybody who goes to the scientific literature can confirm what I am saying. The scientific literature is crystal clear. All of the studies that intended to find scientific support for a gay gene actually proved exactly the opposite. They all demonstrated, sometimes to the shock and dismay of the researchers themselves, that instead of there being evidence for a gay gene, there is solid evidence that homosexuality is in fact largely, predominantly determined by the environment.
Now, I'm interested by the statements by the researchers themselves.
Right.
Who popularly in the press may even be quoted as saying something like, we've found a genetic basis for homosexuality. But in their research, you've got quotes here in the course of this testimony that I have in front of me from the Traditional Values Coalition, that
yes.
Where they come out and say, I didn't prove it.
Well, it's very interesting. They are, this is so... I don't quite have I'll stumble all over myself here because it's
almost
so,
as though
it's
they're
so
saying
outrageous. They don't act. They will never say. I found a gay gene. For example, Dean Hamer, when he testified in the Colorado Proposition 2 case, he said, and I quote here, he said, "I am 99.5% certain that homosexuality is genetic." I have heard him misquoted as saying homosexuality is 99.5% genetic, which is not what he said. He said he's 99.5% certain it's genetic. In other words, if you listen carefully, he was actually saying nothing about the genetics of homosexuality. He was making a statement about his psychological state of mind.
He wants to believe. He's simply saying, I want to believe
that
it's genetic. I haven't proven it.
He was saying nothing about the genetics. He was just saying something about his state of mind. But even worse than that, scientists in this field who are gay activists will say, and this is so tricky, they will say, and this is literally true, homosexuality is 30% heritable. Now, the phrase heritable to the layman is indistinguishable from inherited or genetic. But if you are a genetic scientist, and by the way, most scientists in general don't know what I'm about to say, but you have to be a genetic scientist to know that the term heritable is a technical term that is utterly different from the term inherited. And in order for a behavioral trait to be significantly inherited, its heritability must approach 70%.
In other words, it can be passed down. Whether or not it is passed down is another question.
No, it's subtler than that.
Really?
I mean, I don't want to drive your listeners crazy with these technicalities, so let me just cut to the bottom line here. The point is that a trait, any human behavioral trait, can be 30% heritable. And if it's 30% heritable, it basically means it is almost entirely determined by the environment, as crazy as that statement may sound. So you can stand up and say in public, I just discovered that homosexuality is 30% heritable, and everybody will believe, oh my gosh, that means it must be significantly genetic. And actually, to the person who's in the know, what you've really just said is you've just proven it's almost entirely determined by the environment. And nobody will know that that's what you've just said.
Okay, other claims are built upon this this claim that's not really being made by the researchers. It's being implied by the researchers, and it's being inferred by a society that would like to see this as something that is determined by biology. The another claim that is built upon this is that homosexuality, therefore, must be immutable, that the individual cannot change.
Yes,
Born gay, always gay.
That's correct. Almost everybody will assume that if something is genetic, it therefore cannot be changed. So if you say homosexuality is significantly heritable, immediately people will think, oh, it's genetic, therefore it cannot be changed. Now, the reality is, let me provide some other scientific evidence that essentially nobody knows, nobody except serious scientists. Since 1994, when a major study on human sexuality was performed in the United States by the University of Chicago, and it was discovered in the United States, performed on thousands of people, it was discovered, much to the researcher's surprise, that the majority of young people who form a homosexual identity spontaneously, this has nothing to do with therapy, spontaneously give up that identity after the age of 18, something nobody was aware of. So, far from being fixed, homosexual identity is spontaneously lost. Now, this was so shocking, and of course nobody ever discusses this. This was so shocking to researchers that studies between 1994 and 2004 have been performed in France, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, Minnesota, covering literally hundreds of thousands of individuals, and it has been repeatedly demonstrated over and over and over again, the same phenomenon, that homosexual identity declines spontaneously as people age. So that originally, when this finding was first discovered, it was thought, well, maybe a minority of people spontaneously lose homosexual identity, actually, what the literature demonstrates is that homosexual identity, the change in homosexual identity, is not the exception, it's the rule. Spontaneous change is the rule. So forget about the arguments over can somebody who is determined to change their homosexual identity change, if they wish, with difficulty, in therapy. Of course that must be true, because that sits on top of a spontaneous change rate, which is the rule. It's the exception that somebody does not lose their homosexual identity. And almost nobody knows this. And yet, the scientific literature is sitting there for anybody to examine if they wish.
We're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Satin over about and having him respond to arguments that are commonly held to be true, responding to these arguments for same-sex marriage and for homosexuality. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, Dr. Satinover holds a degree from MIT, Harvard, and the University of Texas. He's practiced psychotherapy and psychiatry since 1974 and authored several books, including Homosexuality and the Politics of Truth, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Ron is on the line, calling from Town and Country. Ron, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, I think we are really bottom line. It amazes me that nobody ever gets down to the bottom line of this. We're talking about sex, pure and simple. And with homosexuality, it's either oral or anal, and that is not natural. I mean, why doesn't anybody ever look at the bottom line facts and say a man's colon was not designed for sex? Women and men are biologically designed for each other. That's part one. Now, part two of the question is, for the homosexuals to be so small a minority, I think around 3 or 5%, it seems that they make the most as far as income compared to other people. They seem to be smarter and more intelligent in areas, in the arts and that. And I've often wondered why these people who are so intelligent, so gifted, fall along this basic base sexual instincts.
Ron, thank you for the call. First of all, that is something that is little discussed, as Ron points out, which is the basic mechanics of the kind of sexual behavior we're talking about, Dr. Satinover.
Well, that's right. And there are many things that can be said about it. I mean, first of all, when we're talking about anal sex, obviously we're talking predominantly about men. And there are many dimensions to it. The most critical one, of course, is that that has everything to do with the AIDS epidemic. And the study of sexuality that I referred to that took place in 1994 was done predominantly because a serious study of sexual behavior was needed in the United States to deal with the AIDS epidemic. There was an interesting political history behind it. Namely, that conservatives in the United States objected to its being done in the first place during the Reagan administration because they considered it asking intrusive questions. Once the study was done, it was primarily liberals that objected to the results of the study because the basic finding of the study was that the AIDS epidemic ended up being restricted to networks of gay males because of the dangers of receptive anal sex. And the major problem in male homosexuality is the approximately 80% prevalence of anal sex. Right now, a 15-year-old boy who considers himself gay basically stands a 65% chance of being either HIV positive or dead of AIDS by the age 30. And that has increased. That 65% likelihood has gone up continually from 30% back in 1996. And the reason that that has continually increased, that risk has increased, is because we are not, our society has failed to address, frankly and directly and unflinchingly, the absolute necessity of dealing with the dangers of gay identity, especially in males.
Let's talk with Jeff. He listens on the internet in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. Jeff, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, thanks for having me. My question was about psychological studies where they find greater instances of depression and suicide.
Yes.
Now, I know from personal experience when I'm doing something I know is wrong, I feel it, you know. I feel it inside. And I was so from a biblical perspective, I was thinking the prima facie case would be that's what it's due to. But I was wondering if there's, I know you mentioned earlier in the show that there's a lot of, it's because of all the societal pressure that is because of this. But it seems to me that there's less societal pressure now than any other time in history. So how would that bear? I didn't know if there's been any legitimate studies to kind of see what these root causes of depression are.
Jeff, that's a great question. In fact, it leads us to the third claim we wanted to deal with, that the disadvantages and the heartache suffered by homosexuals is caused by social disapproval and other forms of discrimination. Let's deal with Jeff's question in that form, Dr. Satinover.
Sure. It's a terrific question, and it opens up some very, very interesting areas. There is a woman named Susan Cochran, who is a gay activist, psychologist, and researcher, who nonetheless has done some very solid research on the relationship between psychological distress, psychopathology, and homosexuality. And here is what her research has shown. Now, there's a morality tale connected to her research. But first, I'll tell you what her research has demonstrated. Her research over a period of about 4 or 5 years, going back to the year 2000, numerous studies, has shown an unequivocal increased incidence of depression, suicide, drug abuse, anxiety disorders in individuals with a gay, lesbian, or bisexual identity. Furthermore, she has taken pains to control for any degree of increased distress that can be attributed to societal bigotry or prejudice. So she's accounted for that, and still finds that there is a clearly increased incidence of psychopathology associated with homosexuality, and has explained that very clearly. And has, in spite of the fact that she, as a gay activist herself, would be inclined, and states this, to dismiss, she would want, if anything, to blame all of the excess psychopathology on societal prejudice, makes it clear that her studies have dealt with that, and there is still an increased incidence of psychopathology associated with homosexuality.
And I would add there, keeping with the caller's point, too, that at least at the present day, and of course these things have evolved in the last decade or so very quickly, at least at the present day, the amount of societal disapproval and discrimination is readily and rapidly declining as well. Dr. Satinover, yes?
Let me add one other point, if I may. In spite of that, the morality tale here is that she is also one of the co-authors of the Lawrence v. Texas Supreme Court case. And in that the brief that was submitted to the Supreme Court, and she's quoted by the deciders, by the Supreme Court justices who decided that case. And in writing that brief, she asserts that there is no increased psychopathology associated with homosexuality, and references her very own studies that demonstrate that there is increased psychopathology.
Finally, Dr. Satinover, and that again is right back where we began this conversation. We only have about 1 minute, no more than a minute. Claim number four that is so widely believed, a society composed of same-sex couples raising children in family-like units will differ from a society composed of traditional family units in no undesirable ways. Respond to that with only 1 minute, if you would.
Certainly, because the underlying claim there is that children raised without fathers will suffer no harm. But what's even more bizarre is the claim that children raised without mothers will suffer no harm. We have mountains of evidence that children raised without fathers do suffer harm. Oddly enough, we don't have mountains of evidence. We only have a small amount of evidence that children raised without mothers do suffer harm. The only reason that we don't have mountains of evidence demonstrating that children raised without mothers will suffer harm is that we haven't until recently as a society arrived at the point of craziness that we actually would embark on an experiment of raising generations of children without mothers so that we would have the damage around to study.
With only 30 seconds, Dr. Satinover, do you expect these claims we've talked about, these four, that are so widely believed, to fall into disrepute at any time soon? With only 30 seconds.
You mean, do I think that we're actually going to back away from what we're doing?
Yeah.
No, unfortunately not. I don't think the signs look particularly good. I think we will have to hit ourselves over the head with a hammer before we realize that we're actually hurting ourselves.
Dr. Jeffrey Satinover, thank you for being our guest.
It's my pleasure.
Dr. Jeffrey Satinover holds degrees from MIT, Yale, Harvard, and the University of Texas. He's practiced psychotherapy and psychiatry since 1974. He has authored several books, including Homosexuality and the Politics of Truth. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about the 8th century theologian Vede the Venerable with Pastor Will Wheaton of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois, and we'll also be talking to Dr. Victor Raj of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis about the Gandhi legacy in India. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. You know, no matter how widely these things are believed, we need to go always, whenever a claim is made, whenever a claim is upheld, whenever we read another headline, go to those, even those who have made the claim in the press, and see if their own research, their own facts, actually support the claims. In this case, they don't. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.